Our session today is worship as theater, Christian worship as theater. That X there, XN is my abbreviation, not just mine, but some other people too. And it's not an X, it's a Chi, as in Cairo. So it's perfectly legitimate to say XN meaning Christian, or XMAS to mean Christmas. It's not irreverent to do that, because it's a Greek letter that simply stands as the initial for CH. C-H-R-I-S-T. Okay, Christian worship as theater. That's what we're talking about today. And as I have said, these sessions have more of the character of quality control and shop talk than they do sales. In other words, it's not so much a Bible study here, this in my session. It's not so much a proclamation of the gospel as asking ourselves, how can we make certain that we got a good product? Quality control. And I have some opinions about that. We took a look yesterday at the tradition, and I defined the tradition, and I defined it on the blackboard, the board out here under the kiosk. I have 9 little meditations that I wrote for radio, and I posted them on the kiosk. Tradition is a way of giving your grandpa and grandma a vote in the decisions that you must make today. A kind of transgenerational democracy. No reason why grandpa and grandma cannot have a vote and a voice. Not the only vote, not the deciding vote necessarily, but we should at least listen to them. We should try to learn to love what grandpa and grandma loved. I mean, that's just polite. And you may learn something. And there's a sense, too, in which I think the tradition judges us. And all of last week, I did a series, 5 sessions, on the worship, Christian worship and the arts. And Kathy and I, as a matter of fact, go to Montana for this coming weekend, where she gives a presentation on the family and family ministry in the congregation, and I do a presentation on the arts. And my subject last week, and you can find those tapes in the tape room if you'd like to look at them or hear them, concerned each of the arts. And we had a session on church architecture, and we had a session on theater, and we had a session on music, and we had a session on words, and we had a session on symbols and artifacts. If you want to see something of what we talked about with architecture, I put it on the board over here on the wall. A blue Advent, green Epiphany season, purple Lent, and yellow Easter. How we rearranged the space when I was at Wartburg Seminary last year. And of course, over here in the Village Center, they can rearrange the space too. And it's kind of fun when you have a flexible space like that, because each arrangement of space preaches a different sermon, you might say. So let's take a look today at Christian worship and theater. And as I have said last week, I would say again today, there is a sense in which Christian pastors and worship leaders and organists and choirs and so on, they ought to know something about these arts and have an appreciation of them even, because they are the languages by which people communicate. And worship is not just the top of the head experience. It's not just words. It's not just verbalizing. But it is the whole person involved. The total person is involved in worship. And the place where we worry about the seating arrangements and how you're going to arrange the space and so on, where you worry about the postures or the gestures or the position of the worship leaders, that kind of thing, where you worry about the music or the vestments or the candles, or the place where all of that converges with faith is at worship Sunday morning. And I found my vocation 5 years after I was ordained. I was already ordained 5 years before it occurred to me, gee, all those things that I love out there in the secular world, first article of the creed, you might say, doctrine of creation, church architecture and music and drama and art and painting and sculpture and all that stuff. I always loved all of that. And the place where they meet Christian faith is at worship. because if you're not dealing with this kind of architectural arrangement, you're just dealing with another kind of architectural arrangement. And if you're not using these hymns and prayers in this book, you're using some other hymns and prayers. And if you're not standing, you know, to say the Lord be with you, you're standing, the Lord be with you. I like to think you speak twice when you have that gesture, right? And Martin Luther says, you sing, those who sing pray twice. Because you have the words, but you also have the melody. And I would say those who use a gesture, or maybe even an expression on the face, pray twice. You have the words, but you also have the gesture that goes along with it. So, my argument is going to be that you cannot do without the arts in any kind of worship, even the most simple, even Bible camp worship. You have to worry about how are you going to gather around the campfire down at the lake or whatever. Where are you going to have people stand or sit? What kind of songs are you going to use? What kind of prayers? What kind of readings? All of that. That's the bus, right? My argument is going to be, and I think I can make a case for it, that you ought to have some knowledge and even some appreciation of all of these arts, or you're not going to be a very good pastor or a very good choir director or a very good choir member or a very good worship committee member or even a very good lay person. I mean, even educated lay people ought to know something about all of these arts. Architecture, music, theater, vessels, artifacts. So, let's look today at Christian worship as theater. And just for fun, we're going to make a kind of extended metaphor here, and we're going to ask, what does the producer do in a play or a movie? What does the director do? What does the production designer do? What does the actor do? Now we're going to apply all of that to Christian worship, and then we're going to, at the very end, we're going to take a look at the new phenomenon where you have the mega churches, for instance, inspired by the church growth movement and so on, where you have them putting on a show. I think we ought to be very clear at the very beginning that we're not interested in putting on a show, that we are interested in inviting everybody who walks in the door to be on stage. Problem is, a lot of our church architecture contributes to the feeling that here you are sitting in an audience and these people up in the chancel, they're performers putting on a show. And I'm going to be critical of that. Kierkegaard, Soren Kierkegaard, no less, 150 years ago, was critical of that. He said, when you walk into worship, it's not as if you're an audience and there are people putting on a show for you and God is in the prompter's box whispering the cues to the performers. It's not that. He says it's as if you're all on stage. Every worshiper is an actor on stage. And the pastor and the worship leader and the choir and the musician and so on, they are prompters in the prompter's box. And it's God who's in the audience. I like that. So we'll come back to that whole thing, but let's for a moment pretend and use this little metaphor here. If you are at all a pastor or a member of a worship committee or a choir director or anything like that, then there's a sense in which you concern yourself with some of these matters here. The producer, for instance, of a play is the person who decides what the play is going to be. And I would argue, and not just me, but some others as well, that Lutherans have some homework to do in making the Holy Communion the chief service every Sunday. That's part of what I have described in the weeks that I've been here as the ecumenical consensus. Where did I put my books? Right here. We're living in a time of wonderful ecumenical agreement about what worship is and what it ought to look like and how you ought to do it. And I flash this book here as a sample of what I'm talking about. You can find it in the bookstore. This is a book, Baptism, Eucharist, and Ministry. It talks about what baptism is, what it means, and how you ought to do it. And they recommend dunking. The Southern Baptists were right all along. what Eucharist is and what it means, and everybody these days is talking about, if not in these words, they're talking about real presence, the presence of Christ. There's not a church that talks about the real absence of Christ. So there's wonderful agreement about what Holy Communion means and ministry. And this is a document that has input from all of these churches: Eastern Orthodox, Oriental Orthodox, Roman Catholic, Old Catholic, Lutheran, Anglican, Reformed, that's Presbyterian and so on, Methodist, United, Disciples, Baptists, Adventist, and Pentecostal. Can you imagine? Now, they're not getting into this kind of stuff quite so specifically, but there's a wonderful agreement, and we're living in an age of wonderful agreement, and we ought to make the most of that. You might also be interested, while I'm thinking of it, of this little book, which is also over there, one of a series, Open Questions in Worship, and I contributed to an essay in this book, What is Contemporary Worship? So, it's the producer that says, we're going to do Mass, we're going to do Holy Communion. We're not going to do morning prayer if it's only the only service that a person is going to come to on Sunday morning. We're going to do Holy Communion. So here at Holden Village, we got Holy Communion every Sunday. And more churches are having Holy Communion every Sunday. I heard a statistic only a couple of weeks ago that the standard in North American Lutheranism, in, south of the border, that is, in the ELCA, I've been living in Canada, north of the border, for the last couple of years, but south of the border, the new standard is not once a month, Holy Communion, but rather twice a month, or even every Sunday. And of course, when I was a kid, it was four times a year. Right? Now, it's the producer who worries about that stuff, and I think we have some homework to do to make sure that our congregations are moving in the direction that this document suggests, namely, that every Christian community ought to be celebrating Word and Sacrament, both, every Sunday. Now you ask, what do the words need? What do we need in worship besides words? Words prayed in prayers, words sung in hymns, words read from the Bible, words preached from the Bible, words spoken in benediction or liturgical responses. What's lacking there? Well, molecules. The stuff that communion, you know, when you go to communion, you're walking, you're going up forward, you're standing, you're eating, you're drinking, you're digesting, you're metabolizing even. And God wants to reach you at the level of your molecules. God wants to reach you and rescue you to the level of your atoms. And that bread and wine at communion and that water at baptism, sacramental worship reminds you of that. And not just you, but the whole creation. God is worried about the molecules in the ozone layer and in the Amazon rainforest, which is being burned down and cut down at terrible rates. The little spotted owl in that forest in Washington or Oregon or wherever it is. They're cutting down the forest and the owl's dying off. I mean, God is interested in not just your ideas, not just your words, not just your doctrines. God is interested in how you live. God is interested in the health of your body and in the health of the body of the creation. That's what sacraments add to the Word. And from the beginning, the Lutheran Church has been a church of Word and Sacrament. Now, we have morning prayer and evening prayer, and we have service of the Word and other forms of worship as well, and they're all very good and we should use them. But on Sunday morning, we ought to see to it that it's Word and Sacrament as the chief service of the day. Now, when should you have it? Should you have a contemporary service and a traditional service? Some have argued that. Well, we want to introduce some of this new stuff and guitar and all that. So let's have two services. Let's have one at 9:30 and one at 11, and one will be contemporary and the other will be traditional. Well, in this essay, I argue against that. And I say it's important, if you can possibly do it, to have one service that mixes both. contemporary and traditional, all mixed together. Sure, there's some great stuff in this book and other stuff. The Marty Haugen stuff that we use over there, this other hymn book, Gather. You know, some of it African American, some of it old Southern Baptist gospel music that Lutherans have never sung before. Blessed Assurance, Jesus is Mine. That's in this book. Can you imagine? African, some African stuff that's wonderful. It should probably be done with drums. And over here in the village center, they do it with drums. I mean, it's neat. Guitar, harp, sounding cymbals. I mean, the Psalms talk about all of that. Give us permission. So let's use all of that wonderful, new, exciting stuff that's coming from other cultures and that's being recently written. But also, let us honor Grandpa and Grandma in the tradition. And let's sing Herr Jesu Christ, Dich zu uns wendt. I mean, you know, some of those German chorales. that's part of our Lutheran heritage. And if you have an African-American congregation that likes to sing the gospel hymns, I think that's terrific. I'd like to learn some of them too. But I want to teach that African-American congregation how to sing Lob den Herrn, praise to the Lord, the Almighty, the King of Creation, German chorale. And in a Lutheran hymn book, the German chorales are non-negotiable. They belong in a Lutheran hymn book. If I saw a Methodist hymnal, I'd want to see the hymns of Charles Wesley. John and Charles Wesley, you know, the founders of Methodism. And Charles Wesley wrote 6,000 hymns. Not all of them are very good, but some are great. Love Divine, All Loves Excelling. Oh, do you get any better than that? No. Wonderful hymn. And I want to hear Charles Wesley hymns in a Methodist church. I want to hear Lutheran chorales in the Lutheran church. And in all of those churches, I want to hear some African stuff and some Caribbean stuff and some South American stuff. And, you know, we got a wonderful tradition that we ought to be using. And I would say mix them up. And I argue in this book that if you have two services, the 9:30 people don't know the 11 o'clock people. Aren't I right? I mean, you're dividing the congregation unnecessarily. And if you begin to have designer services, we're going to have a rock and roll service, and then we're going to have a country and western service. You know, that's not the Christian church anymore. Go ahead, interrupt me anywhere along the line, and I hope at the end we'll have some open conversation.
Paul, I just wanted to make sure I'm hearing you right. When you're talking about two services, are you talking about dividing for the sake of tailoring services, or are you addressing also the issue of space? For instance, I am an associate pastor, and a congregation has a worship space about like this room here.
And we have the people just can't all fit.
Yeah. So we have three services on Sunday, which is awful.
that's another problem. If you have a building that just doesn't accommodate everybody, then you just have to have two services, or three maybe. I mean, that's legitimate.
And I guess I'd like to say to that, we have a full-time worship and music person who has a general sense of the early service being the more traditional, but she does mix them up from week to week. She does expose people to different traditions, and so we are three different congregations. I mean, we talk
definitely
about that.
Yeah, and you should be aware of that. Sociologically, what you've got now, you are a circuit rider.
Yeah.
Just like the old Methodist with the saddlebags and the horse. Except you're not going 600 miles or whatever to your church. You're going in the same building, but at a different hour. And it's a different sociological group. And maybe I would even like to see this happen. I've never seen it happen in Lutheranism. But if you have a big church, that means I assume a big staff. Mm-hmm. And maybe we should have one pastor assigned to one of those congregations all the time. And a second pastor assigned to the second one, you know, one at 8 o'clock and one at 9:30 and one at 11. Well, different, maybe even a different Sunday school and a different church council for each of them. I mean, that could be very cumbersome. But practicality is not the last word or even the first word. When you're talking church life.
Yeah, I don't want to get too far afield here, but that's one of my issues, and I don't have the strongest voice in the congregation, but my feeling is that congregations, when they have a space problem, the automatic response is, well, we got to build. And we have a neighboring Lutheran congregation, which has a huge space, few people in it, and you know, my feeling
terrible. It's a white elephant
together. Yeah. This Reformation Sunday, we are all three of these congregations within a congregation are coming together for a Sunday evening service, so that at least once we're all
sure.
together.
I think you should do that
in the future. But I guess I've tried to challenge our council. It hasn't gone anywhere, but I've said, you know, what if instead of building, we were to merge with this other congregation so that we could all worship together? Or what if we were to divide into smaller congregations?
Right.
And this is like, you know, whoa.
That's more. Your suggestion is more sensible to me. I would be very leery about building a huge building.
Yeah.
Almost every cathedral-type church that I know results in two things. First of all, it's a monument to the ego
yes.
of the person who built it,
yeah.
the bishop or the pastor a lot of times. And second, it is a white elephant to succeeding generations.
Yeah.
And I argue in here that there ought to be an optimum size for a church building and maybe an optimum size to a Christian congregation.
Yeah.
If it's big enough that it needs a PA system, it's too big. We should hear the naked human voice, and I've been fighting that battle for 25 years at Holden Village. Tear out that PA system over here. It's terrible. I don't know a PA system that doesn't squawk or squeal or hum at the wrong time.
There's a huge
including
stewardship
this one.
Piece in that, too. I mean,
don't trust anything you have to plug in.
But for me, it's stewardship, too. You know, if we're looking at $1.5 million building project, what could this money be used for?
Yeah.
And it's not hard to justify. I mean, people say, well, yeah, but once we build it, we'll be able to do all this. But that, to me, is just too easy.
Yeah, does the Christian church in Western civilization need another church building?
Yeah.
Boy, I don't know. I think there's an ethical issue there.
Yes.
Don't we have enough church buildings in Western civilization, by which I mean Western Europe and North America? Can't we scrounge space that we already have? Can't we put that money to better use in other ways? Architects hate for me to make this speech, but what we ought to do is renovate some of the spaces that we have and not build any more cathedrals. The cathedrals in Europe are wonderful architecture, but they're terrible churches. I mean, they're terrible for worship.
Yeah.
They're great for processions, but of course that was all they did in the Middle Ages. I mean, it wasn't necessary that you saw or heard what was going on. You just had to be present. You know, Martin Luther had some opinions about Gothic, you know, using the Gothic Age as the age of faith. Well, I'm not sure it was the age of faith. It was the age of church triumphalism, that's certainly true, and they're marvelous buildings. I mean, I've been there and I've seen them, but they're terrible for Christian worship if you want to have a community. Something else?
You were talking about offering one service, you know, with a more traditional and then another service with more contemporary. Well, up in Bonner's Ferry, we've started using the Marty Halkin service.
Ah, mm-hmm.
But we have always had two services during the year, one service during the summer, but we talked about maybe, you know, having one service with one and the other, but we decided as a worship committee that divides the congregation.
It does.
So what we do is we have traditional the first Sunday, we have Marty Halkin the second Sunday, then we have traditional the third Sunday. The first three Sundays are always with the Eucharist, and the third Sunday is full tradition without.
Uh-huh. Let me encourage you to rethink that when you go back home. Say you heard somebody at Holden who said, better than every other week or every 3 weeks or whatever would be to do it by a season of the church year. In other words, for the 4 weeks of Advent, we're coming at 9:30 and we're doing the same thing, whatever it is. And then the weeks of Christmas Epiphany, we're doing something different. And then the weeks of Lent, we're doing something. My feeling is that people's, oh dear, what Sunday of the month is it? Do we have to get ready for it? You know, our psyche, our human psychology doesn't work on every other week type of thing. It works better in a block. And I think you're being more fair to Marty Halkin or to whatever you're using if you can use it week after week for at least 4 weeks, and maybe even 6 weeks would be better. So I would encourage that.
Well, we did first introduce a bit of that when we, it was either an Advent or something where we used a Marty Halkin mm-hmm. every Wednesday evening on Advent to start them getting used to something like that. And then we did this one, but our people really like it.
Yes, and the Marty Hogan stuff is terrific.
They seem to like what we're doing, and they seem to be into it.
Sure, very good, very good. My only critique would be, you might think in terms of using whatever service it is for a period of a couple of weeks at a time, so people can begin to savor it and get used to it and feel into it. And
would that be another way of emphasizing a season?
And it would be a way, exactly, of educating people in the church year. You know, that's so important.
Well, somehow or other, I like what you're saying. People have to be aware of just those things, or they don't know even the seasons. You see that? There has to be a certain competence, if you want to say that. If you mentioned that in your introduction, that this is what people should know. What do you do if the leadership, either committee or clergy or anything else, is just incompetent?
Who is what?
Is incompetent.
Yeah, that's a tough one, boy.
I mean, a lot of people just walk out. That's perhaps not the Christian way to do. On the other hand, in the cultural situation in America, to raise your voice on these things is very, it's misunderstood.
Yeah. That's a tough one. I would hope that such people are willing to go to places like Holden Village or to conferences or workshops or worship festivals and so on, where they could increase their competence a little bit. And
well, for a while, you see, I'm speaking, of course, about my parish, Trinity, in Tacoma. And that used to be a Norwegian village 10 miles south of the center. Everybody belonged there, you know.
Sure.
And I think that it was great. The congregation, however, has gone through a lot of changes. And so you can't expect that to be the same sort of thing. And during the last time, well, it was Pastor Finch who was here in Spokane. And he, together with others, worked at a parish diaconate, which worked extremely well in giving just such competence that people really need.
Sure.
And, you know, with a university across the street and lots of possibilities, it was really quite a good program. However, when the new broom came, a new pastor, and this is not saying anything of him personally, but as far as this was concerned, this threatened him. He did not know the names of the utensil for communion, which all the people in the altar guild know and still know, and still keep up the tradition.
Yeah.
And it really threatened him.
Yeah.
So he actually strangled the diaconate, where people had been ordained to do that work. And I really felt sorry for him and for the people. It's just devastating.
Yeah, I'll bet.
In many ways. Finally, then, when we got an assistant there, that was given to him, but it never recovered. You see that? Never recovered, and so well. And we've had fine pastors in between and since that, but I guess what you're saying, I think, needs to be said and needs to be heard and worked. And I really like your basic ideas here, but in the living situation in American culture today, where things are changing so fast, we have an awful lot of people who really like to come to a big church with the organ and the choir and living people of all ages, and so we draw. But they don't stay.
They're turned off by incompetent leadership.
They're not turned off. They will come. They'll even join, you see that? But this is not the old congregation where you stayed from cradle to the grave.
Yeah.
That part of the congregation is still there.
Yeah.
But this is quite... So in other words, I'm saying the cultural aspect of America with its fast changes is simply caught up with Parkland.
Yeah, it's... if you don't have the leaders on board, and if the leaders are incompetent or do not feel...
threatened.
What's
or
your...
Or threatened.
Or feel threatened, yeah, right. Boy, that's a big problem. You're probably aware that... prior to the introduction of the Green Book, the LBW, the LCA, ALC, and even Missouri Synod in those days went together, and every summer they had 10 or 12 worship conferences that introduced this new material.
And we always had them at PLU, sure.
PLU was a site. I was there at least twice as a faculty member in one of those conferences at PLU. And other, they used other schools too. And it was a wonderful series of conferences. I think for 26 years, I was part of the faculty of such a conference. And then they killed it. I don't know if it was austerity or what, but they don't have such conferences anymore, unfortunately. In Canada, they do. Every 2 years now, there is a major national worship conference. And I would plead with you in the American church to pound on the door of your bishop and say, hey, we need a worship conference every summer or every two summers at the least. At a place like Holden Village or at a place like Tacoma or a place like wherever, where we can have our pastors and our choir directors and our worship committee people introduced to some competence in these fields.
Well, I should add, too, that then, fortunately, because after the senior pastor and his wife, who was the organist, left, and they were a nice team, we had, within 1 year, five choir directors. If you have PLU in the music department, you can always have music. You can always have organists. You can have, well, whatever, you know, is popular. And so we had that. And long and short is that what we did is try to follow the pattern of PLU in getting an organist and choir director. And we got one trained at Yale.
Wow.
And it was Greg Peterson. He was excellent. And with the help of this pastor, who at first was threatened by all these things, the congregation came to worship, responded very quickly, and it was largely that leadership. And the pastor acknowledged it. You see that?
Sure.
And would say, you know, that when he installed the altar, you know, this used to threaten me, it doesn't anymore. So he was very honest, very open. So I think there are a lot of, resources within the congregation.
There are.
But you still need somebody, like you said, to know what those things are. If they don't know, if they're choosing the hymns and don't know the hymnody, hear Greg Peterson from Yale and from his background in Minnesota at St. Olaf in that congregation. His father was there. He graduated from Luther. He knew it, you see that? And it worked.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Where? Well, you're probably stuck with the building. There's not much question about where in most cases. But I like, again, this flexible space that we have here. And a lot of churches have a flexible hall. What's the word I'm looking for? Assembly hall or parish hall kind of thing. And you might have worship there. Not regularly on Sunday necessarily, but midweek or at special events, that kind of thing. Let's take a look at the director. What does the director do in a play? Well, the director is responsible, among other things, for pushing the actors around and telling them where to stand and helping them with their posture and their position and so on. The shape of the drama, where is the climax and so on, that kind of matters, the mood and the style. You know, a service in Lent is going to have a different mood, isn't it? A different style from a service in the Easter season. Let's take a look even in such things as blocking. Blocking means where you stand. If you stand, and I've been on a crusade here this year and other years that I've been here to get people to stand up when they sing hymns and to stand up when they pray prayers. I wrote an essay just recently about couch potato prayers. Here I am sitting, you know, and I'm supposed to be singing, stand up for Jesus, the soldiers of the cross. You know, I mean, oh dear, terrible. Where does this come from? We should stand to sing hymns. We should stand to pray prayers. We should stand for liturgical responses. Now, all of that is in the hands of the director and the pastor and the worship leaders, and you want to take cues from them. So over here, when I'm simply a congregational member, if the worship leader is sitting down, I'm going to sit down too. I'm not going to leap to my feet in most cases. I did do it on a couple of occasions, but I think the human spirit sings best in a standing posture. Sure, there's some people who have arthritis or who are in a wheelchair, or even parents with little wiggly kids who cannot stand up. And we should allow that and be gracious about that.
But sometimes these parents with wiggly kids do better when they can stand up.
Exactly. Kids need to move. Exactly. And I said yesterday, was it, that kids are the children are the miner's canary of worship. You know, in the mine, they would take a canary down, and if the canary died, they knew it was time to get out of the mine because the gas was building up. Well, if children are bored or restless at worship, something is wrong.
And if you stand up with your children, they can see what's going on.
Exactly, and I'd put them right in the front row. Uh-huh. And we were parents with kids at one time, and we got a grandchild now. Take them right down to the front so they can see all that action and be part of it. And we all have lots of standing and sitting and processing and moving and dancing. Liturgical dance, I mean, my goodness, our worship is much too couch potato. Wouldn't you agree? And all these attractive, vigorous young people here sitting night after night for worship. Terrible. Well, I made that speech. The production designer is the one who worries about the look of the production. Star Wars, wasn't that wonderful? They had all these futuristic machines, but they had dents in them and rust and so on. I mean, it was very convincing, and they built a whole new world that you willingly gave yourself to. And I think the look of our worship spaces ought to, you know, we ought to be conscious that there's a certain appearance that we're giving here. Is the garbage picked up? You know, is the place unlittered? Is there furniture here that doesn't belong and that isn't been used? Take it out. Don't leave it here. I've been disappointed, and I told the people this, that we're not using that wonderful Arne Flotten altar. Have some of you been to Holden Village before? Raise your hand. A couple of you have. You know what I mean when I say the Arne Flotten altar? Arne Flotten was one of the great sculptors. Is he still alive? He might be. He's an old man, though. Anyhow, he's one of America's great sculptors. And he did church reredoses and altars and pulpits and so on in a lot of churches in the Midwest, some other places too. But he was an early visitor to Holden, and he took railroad ties, and he made an altar and a pulpit. You remember it.
Yeah.
An altar and a pulpit out of railroad ties. And then he carved in the face of it the altar, the body, this is my body given for you, and on the other side, the blood of Christ shed for you, the body of Christ given for you. And on the pulpit, I think it says, we have this treasure. And they're still here. They're stored away behind the curtain ignominiously on the stage over here, stored away. And I said, oh, we ought to pull them out. I mean, they're pieces of art. They're wonderful. Now, granted, you have to fuss with it. You have to put it apart, you know, take it apart and put it back together again. It fits together like a puzzle. And it's heavy. And it's hard work, and every time you want to use the place for a dance or for something else, you got to take it apart, and every time you want to have communion, you got to put it back in. But again, convenience is not the last word, or even the first word, when it comes to worship. Feeding the human soul is the most important thing. And I would like to argue that feeding the human soul, Arne Flotten altar and Arne Flotten pulpit, that feeds the human soul in a way that this one that they have here now does not. That's very workmanlike, and it's okay. It's not tacky, the one they have now. But the one that Flotten made is a work of art. And people know that. Even the illiterate or the unlearned or the unlettered or the unsophisticated in the arts, they know the difference between what is good and what is less than good. And the human spirit is fed by good stuff. And we live in a plastic age. Again, I'm not saying that the present altar and pulpit are plastic or tacky or not worthy, but the one that that's stored away on the stage, that's really great. And people are fed by seeing that day after day.
Let's put it in there during a season when there is no dancing.
Well, and you only need the altar on Sunday, you know, you only need it for Eucharist, so you know, it wouldn't be that big a deal. For Vespers, all you need is a lectern.
We need it on a different type of dolly.
Well, it raises it up. I kind of like the fact that it's on the ground.
But you have to have it in something that's mobile. Anyway.
Anyhow, moving along. How about the actor? Again, the people are the chief actors, and we always ought to keep that in mind. The people themselves, the people in the pew, the people in the chairs, they are the most important part of that whole thing.
Why did you say that the choir is the witness of
the choir is...
Did you say that choir was the audience earlier? Maybe I misunderstood.
Did I say that? No. No, the choir is one of the prompters. The choir is one of the enablers of the people's praise.
Okay, I understand.
Same with the organist and musicians, whether they're guitar or drums or whatever. They are helping the people praise. Any art form has three functions in worship. Where will I put this? I'll take up too much space here. First of all, to enable the people's praise, simply to help the people's praise. Second, to enrich the people's praise. That would be like anthems. And three, edify the body, as in concerts and cantatas and stuff like that. But number one, that's the most important. In other words, if I was the boss, I would have a choir and a choir director and a musician who spent most of their time every week at rehearsal looking at the hymns, making sure that they understand those wonderful words and those wonderful melodies and give the most to them, that they took a look at the psalm for the day. In our Holy Communion is a very important part. We're recovering the Psalms, we're rediscovering the Psalms. We're living in an age when the Psalm book has been rediscovered by all the churches, Presbyterian, Roman Catholic, you name it. And those Psalms shouldn't just be read, they should be sung. And they should be sung maybe with instruments, and maybe the women sing one verse and the men sing another verse, and there's a refrain. I mean, there's wonderful stuff that you can do with Psalms. And this book here has a lovely collection of Psalms, most of them with a kind of a refrain here in the very beginning. Pass that book around. Most of them have a refrain that the congregation sings, same refrain all the time, and a voice, a solo, or the women in the choir, or the men in the choir, or whatever, and a lot of attention, and a lot of time, and a lot of care, and a lot of love should be lavished on the liturgy itself, the hymns themselves, and the psalm for the day. Only when the choir has done all of that should they worry about number two, an anthem. Anthem is not necessary every Sunday in Lutheran worship. Psalm is. Hymns are. Liturgy are. But not anthem. We don't need an anthem. We do need a psalm that is sung with intelligence and imagination and passion. Any of you been to the Valparaiso Worship Institutes? Valparaiso University in Valparaiso, Indiana has a worship institute every April. And it's wonderful. And you go to the services there, and the psalms just blow you away. Of course, they got Phil Gehring, and they got Richard Hillert, and you know, some of the great musicians. But you'll be singing a psalm, and the instructions are printed there, or they'll tell you what the instructions are. Usually the people just sing a refrain, and it's the same refrain all the time. Here you go, I'll give you an example. My refuge, my stronghold, my God, in whom I trust. You sing that. My refuge, my stronghold, my God, in whom I trust. Those who dwell in the shelter of the Most and abide in the shade of the Almighty, say to the Lord, my refuge,
My stronghold, my God, in whom I trust. Your turn. My refuge, my stronghold, my God, in whom I trust. God shall deliver you from the snare of the hunter, etc. You know, you see how it goes? A singer, maybe a solo, maybe voices from the choir, sing the verses, and then the people sing that refrain. It's wonderful. And at these Valpo conferences, they'll have maybe trumpets coming in suddenly on one of the verses. I mean, boy, that's the first job of the choir, to help enable the people to do their part. The anthem, that's an enrichment. How are we doing time-wise?
Ten
more minutes? And the same would be true of drama. The first job of a drama troupe would be to, let's say, explicate or illustrate the scripture reading. Last week, we had a Vespers out here at the Ark, and I read the story of Noah and the Ark, and we had invited ahead of time the little kids to bring their stuffed animals. And when it was time to go on the Ark, Noah and his family gathered up all the little kids and all their stuffed animals, and they went on the Ark. I mean, it was wonderful. The kids themselves, in other words, were acting out, but we had Kathy was Mrs. Noah, and one of the guests was Mr. Noah with a fake beard and a shawl around his neck and a staff, and we even had the rainbow. Anyhow, I like to think it was well received, and that it was the gospel. You were here, weren't you, Ralph?
Yeah, sure, but I didn't know who Noah was.
It was lots of fun. Anyhow, there's no reason why we couldn't have a little drama choir, the way same way we have a vocal choir. And the drama choir, on special occasions, maybe not every Sunday, but on special occasions, would act out the gospel for the day. Or read as a choral reading the epistle. Have you seen the dramatized Bible? You ought to take a look at that. It's big bucks. It's, I think, $60. But it's the whole Bible cut into small sections and dramatized like a script. Even the Psalms and the Proverbs, like for a vocal choir. What's the word I'm looking for? Choral speech, you know, that kind of thing. And, of course, the stories, oh, they're wonderful.
Who was the editor, or who did that?
It's called The Dramatized Bible, and you can get it from the Bible Society. You can in Canada, anyhow. Okay, so posture, position, and gesture. I've said a little bit of words about that. Voice, you ought to worry about the nouns and the verbs in most sentences. If you're speaking, they carry the weight, and the vowels carry the music, and the consonants carry the meaning in most English sentences, anyhow, and you ought to train people to speak. You don't need a PA system. Train people to project their voice. Moving on, let us take a look at entertainment evangelism. And again, these are the mega churches who are trying to put on a big tent show, is what it amounts to. They will maybe resent my describing it in those terms, but that's really what it is. If you press some of them, they will say, well, we're really not worshiping here on Sunday morning. We're trying to get secular people in the door. We're trying to hook them, and then our real worship is on Wednesday night. But I'll bet the people who come on Sunday morning think that that's worship. And they are encouraged to think of themselves as an audience, and here are performers putting on a show for them. With a full four or five piece band, and microphones, and woofers, and tweeters, and electronic mixing board, and all that stuff. And the congregational participation is very minimal. You may sing a chorus or two, and you may say the Lord's Prayer, and that's it. Now I would be critical of that kind of thing. For the following four reasons. Ritual contract, that's the first thing. That's a fancy term for what do you expect when you walk in the door? Do you expect to be an audience, entertained? And you vote up or down whether the entertainment is good or bad, and you give offering on the offering plate accordingly. I don't think that's the right model. I think when you walk in a church door, you should expect to be invited on stage. That's the contract. Now, you may not want to be on stage. You may want to sit in the back row. That's what the back rows are for. We shouldn't have Lutherans sitting in the back row. We should have strangers and visitors and the uncommitted sitting in the back row. Lutherans should sit in the front row. And the ritual contract, when you walk in the door, you should feel invited on stage. You may not want to be, you may want to just come in from the cold and warm up a little bit. That's what the back rows are for. But all worshipers ought to feel that they are participants and not just couch potatoes with a clicker turning the channel. That's one. Two, infantilization. I've been to some of these services and they got thousands of people there. My Lord, do they pack them in. But it's infantilization. They're being infantilized. They are not encouraged to stretch their faith. You know a hymn like Zu Lebensbrot. That's a German chorale, one of my favorites, hymn 208 in the Green Book. You don't have the Green Book, forget it, you don't need it. But I mean, that's a hymn that stretches your imagination. It stretches your spiritual antenna or whatever. Everything does not have to be immediately accessible in Christian worship. If you walk in the door of a Christian church and it looks a little different from a talk show with Oprah or whoever, Jay Leno, I mean, there's no reason why Christian worship ought to look like a television talk show. No reason why it has to look like a rock concert. If it looks a little different, if you perceive it as something a little foreign to you, that's okay. You ought to be willing to learn, and the pastor and the leaders then ought to be helpful in helping you learn, inviting you into the mysteries. It doesn't all have to be immediately self-evident. It ought to be something you grow into. St. Paul talks about the faith and growing into maturity in Christ. Anyone want to comment about that? Well, I'll give you a few minutes here at the very end. Word reductionist. Again, a lot of this entertainment type worship is what I would call word reductionist. It reduces everything in worship to words. Words that you speak, words that you read from Bible, words that you hear preached, words that you hear prayed. And it is anti-sacramental. Not just non-sacramental, but it actually is anti-sacramental. It does not train people in a sacramental life. It doesn't concern itself with the stuff of reality. And the stuff of reality is part of God's witness. Finally, is anti-ecumenical. As I have said, the consensus that I see among all the churches is moving in this direction. And I see entertainment and the tent show type of thing as moving us in another direction. And it's something we've seen before. I mean, 100 years ago, 150 years ago, with the revivalist movement and the tent revivals of Southern Baptists and so on. There were Lutherans in Gettysburg Seminary in those days. Samuel Simon Schmucker, maybe you know that name from church history. And Samuel Simon Schmucker wanted to make Lutherans more like Methodists and Southern Baptists. And he, for a while, wanted to move Lutherans in the direction of a kind of a tent meeting frontier revivalism. But there were other voices at the time that resisted that, and I think resisted it wisely. Revivalism and that whole frontier experience has deeply affected American religion generally, and it's affected Lutherans too. And as I say, we have some remnants of it here with Blessed Assurance, Jesus is Mine, now in this book. Even, Amazing Grace, How Sweet the Sound, you know. That's not part of our background, but we can appropriate it, and that's okay. But there's other stuff in it that we don't want to appropriate. Chiefly this notion that you're an audience watching some flashy evangelist, you know, sell you something. A lot of Americans are getting very cynical about the television evangelists and these salesmen.
for the gospel at, you know. Anyhow, I have some problems with that, as you may too. I don't think it's very good entertainment, and I don't think it's very good evangelism. I don't think it's initiating people, welcoming people into the fullest truth about God. Fullest truth about God is word and sacrament, not just word. And it's divisive in the parish too, I think. I think it teaches scorn for the tradition and teaches contempt for the Green Book, for instance, and we don't want to do that. That's a wonderful book. That's the book that's in most of our churches, and we can be proud of it. One day it's going to be superseded by another book, Purple Book or whatever, so it's not the last word. Nothing is ever the last word in faith, but meantime it's our gift, and we should respect it. Well, you want to say something? Go ahead.
Well, the comments that you were just making, how then would you introduce people to worship who have not been raised in the church and who come in and it's almost like a foreign language?
It is a foreign language, yeah. It's a big job and it's very difficult, and you do have to spend time educating. I would preach, if I were a pastor, preach about worship and what it means. I would write little items in the newsletter, parish newsletter. I would have little paragraphs in the Sunday bulletin with some regularity. I would have courses.
Some of these people only give you two times. You know, they're there once and they said, well, we'll try it one more time just to make sure we really don't like it.
Yeah.
you don't have a chance to educate them to what we're doing or why they're invited to be a part, and they feel uncomfortable being a part when they really don't know the body.
Yeah.
You know, and
part of it is leadership. You have seen services, I'm sure you have, as I have, where the pastor comes out and says, well, and now here's a service book, and here's a copy of Celebrate, and here's a copy of the bulletin announcements, and it's going to mean you're going to have to read a lot, and if you forgot your bifocals, you're in trouble, or if you never learned to read, a lot of adults, you know, who are functionally illiterate, you're going to be in trouble then too, and it's going to mean a lot of hard work, and you aren't going to like it, and I don't like it very much either, but let's all turn to page 77. I mean, oh dear, that's dreadful. What do these evangelists on TV and these big mega churches have that we should have? Enthusiasm on the part of the leaders. They come bounding out, we got a great show for you today. Well, I don't think I'd want to use those terms, but I think the pastor ought to have some enthusiasm for what's going on, and that telegraphs. Look, this is exciting stuff, kids. Look what happens here in this hymn in the second verse. You know, the words or the melody or whatever. And look at this wonderful new liturgical form that we're going to use, Marty Haugen or whatever. Or even the third setting. Any of your churches ever use third setting in here? Great stuff. So part of it is leadership, and the leadership has to be committed and enthusiastic, and if that happens, then I think visitors and strangers can pick up some of it.